Call to order the regular Planning Commission meeting for the City of San Bernardino. Commissioner Jones, would you lead us in the flag salute, please?
Please stand.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Ms. Perez, would you call the roll?
Chair Heasley?
Here.
Commissioner Machen?
Here.
Commissioner Lopez?
Here.
Commissioner Gallagher?
Here.
Commissioner Earp?
Here.
Commissioner Jones?
Present.
Commissioner Quill?
Here.
Vice Chair Durr, Commissioner Ebley, Commissioner Jones, absent.
Commissioner Jones is...
Oh, my apologies. We have quorum.
Thank you. Consent agenda. The consent items are considered routine in nature and may be enacted in one motion. All public and non-public hearings will be opened at one time. Any item may be discussed separately upon a request of a member of the Planning Commission or a member of the public. What do we have for the consent agenda tonight?
There are two items, Chair, on the consent calendar. The first is the minutes of the November 16th, 2016 meeting, and staff is recommending approval of those. The second is repeal of Resolution 99-01, which are the Planning Commission bylaws that were adopted in 1999. Staff is recommending that those bylaws be repealed and that the chair appoint a subcommittee to work with staff and develop new bylaws. The 99 bylaws are obviously very dated and need to be updated. We think that can be accomplished by March, and we're recommending approval of Resolution 2016-069, which would repeal Resolution 99-01.
Thank you. Any commissioners wish to pull any item from the consent agenda? At this time, I could, before we actually do the appeal, or do I have to do the repeal vote before I appoint or ask for subcommittee members?
I don't think the sequence of events matters. You could approve these two consent calendar items if that's the desire of the commission, and then you could appoint a subcommittee.
Okay, at that time, I'll entertain a motion.
I move.
Consent agenda?
Consent agenda. The approval
is... I have a motion.
Second.
I have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Unanimous. I think I'll delay until towards the end of our meeting and take care of the other more pressing business first before I ask for volunteers for a committee to work with staff on writing us a new set of bylaws. Public hearing items. The Planning Commission will first hear a report from staff, then the public hearing will be open. The applicant will have an opportunity to speak. Next, members of the public will be allowed 3 minutes to speak. Anyone in the audience wishing to speak must be sworn in and also fill out a request to speak form. The forms are located on a table near the door. When your name is called, come forward, speak into the microphone, say and spell your name, and give your address for the taped record. After all is spoken, the applicant will be allowed to respond. The public hearing will then be closed, and Planning Commission will begin deliberations and make a decision. All actions except general plan amendments and amendments to the Municipal Development Code are final action unless an appeal is filed and a fee paid within 15 days to the Community Development Department. If you challenge the resultant action of the Planning Commission in court, you may be limited to raising only those issues you or someone else raised at the public hearing described in this agenda, or in written correspondence delivered to the Community Development Department at or prior to the public hearing. Ms. Perez, would you administer the oath? Anybody wishing to speak, now is the time to stand up.
Please stand and raise your right hand. Do you solemnly affirm that the testimony you are about to give before this body will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? If so, please say I do. Thank you. You may be seated.
Agenda item 3, development permit type P16-01.
Good evening, Mary Blaze, contract planner. This is a proposal for a long-term truck and trailer parking facility. It's located at 379 East 3rd Street. It's zoned office industrial park. It has an industrial general plan designation. It's 4.6 acres. Currently, the site is vacant. It consists of 5 parcels. The proposal includes 22 truck and 86 trailer parking spaces, a small 528-square-foot modular office, perimeter landscaping, fencing, and a number of required improvements. The location map shows the zoning in the context of the surrounding zoning. Go ahead. This is an aerial map that shows the site. It's vacant. You can see the existing uses to the west, generally commercial-type uses, service commercial, and you can see a little sliver of the multifamily residential to the east. As I said, as you saw, the site is vacant. It's constrained with a number of easements, which you'll see a slide later that shows all the constraints. It also has a number of overhead power lines that are difficult and not a candidate to underground. This proposal is easily adaptable to those constraints. It complies with the applicable development code provisions. It meets the industrial design guidelines. It's going to provide a controlled access, secured perimeter. It'll be partially obscured and buffered through large-sized trees, shrubs, and vines. The applicant provided a photometric plan for us to show that the lighting will be controlled within the property lines. And the proposed use is designed to serve the city's expanding warehouse distribution uses. This is the map that shows all the constraints. There's a number of different types of easements that are all over the site running through north to south, east, and west. So it's been difficult for other types of traditional industrial users to be attracted to the site. The site plan shows the access in the northeast corner along 3rd Street. The little modular building will be about a little over 100 feet from 3rd Street. It will not be very visible because of the proposed landscaping. You can see most of the site is surface parking for the truck and trailer parking. There's also an existing block wall along the eastern property line, which I'll show you a photo of that in a second. The landscape plan shows that the intent of this landscape design is to provide mature landscaping along 3rd Street and along the view corridors that might be visible from Waterman. There's also going to be mature trees, shrubs, vines along that block wall. Between this use and the adjacent multifamily use on the east. This is an elevation of the small modular building. It's less than 15 feet tall, and there's just enough office space for the 5 or so employees that are planned. This is a representative of what the modular building might look like. They're going to use more subdued colors. But it will be handicap accessible, just like this building. The next slides are photos of the existing site conditions. This is looking west towards Waterman at the existing driveway on the site. This is near the northwest corner of the property. Looking south, you can see the existing commercial along the west, the debris on the site, and it's accumulated quite a bit of garbage. Next slide. This is a picture of that block wall that I talked about that separates the multifamily use on the east. It's about 6 feet tall, and it has, you know, wrought iron on the top. Another view from the southwest corner looking north, again showing the existing commercial building and the site conditions. Another view from the site looking towards 3rd Street. And this is the existing substation that is directly behind the site to the south. So we're recommending that the Planning Commission adopt Resolution 2016-068, adopting the categorical exemption and approving the development permit 16-05 based on the findings of fact and subject to conditions of approval.
Thank you. Any questions for Commissioner Lopez?
Go ahead.
Commissioner Geller.
I just had a question. On the east side of the block wall that separates the property to the multifamily area, is that part parking for the multifamily area, or does the actual living quarters butt up right against the fence?
If you go back a couple of slides, Travis, you'll see there's a footprint. There you go. That's good. The site can, there you go. You can see the building footprints in this slide.
If you get a little closer to your mic, we can't hear you. All right.
In this slide, you can see the building footprints of the multifamily use. It's a lot of landscaping that abuts the property line and buildings and some parking.
Okay.
Commissioner Lopez.
When it says operation of truck and trailer parking facility, you're talking about the 18-wheelers, you're talking about that.
Yes.
When it says a parking facility, what does that mean? What is the business there, to park your 18-wheeler when you're not driving it? Or
I'll let the applicant explain more about the operations, but they're going to be storing those tractor trailers.
I have one question concerning the paving of it. We've had an experience with a granular improved surface, which didn't work well in another part of the city. So I couldn't find any indication as to what type of pavement they were planning on putting down. So I can either wait until the developer applicant.
Okay.
Welcome.
Hi. Excuse me. Ed Bondeman with Joseph E. Bondeman Associates. We represent the applicant. My address is 234 North Arrowhead, San Bernardino. First off, thank you very much to staff. You know, you guys, this city is very blessed because they've got some of the, you have some of the best staff right now that you've had in a long, long time. And they're moving projects forward and getting them to the bodies. And I'm really happy with staff right now. I just want to, you probably don't get a lot of kudos, so I'd like to do that once in a while. So this will be a lot like we just built the Schneider facility down on Auto Center and Fairway. And that's a long-term trailer, truck and trailer parking. And so this will be, it's a lot smaller than that one, but it'll be similar. So they'll come in, they'll park trailers, the trailers will be there for however long they need to be there logistically until they need to move them out.
And that won't include the tractors that draw them?
Sometimes. We've got some of the truck parking spaces there as needed. And we have employee parking. So it's just, there'll be typically empty trailers parked there. And that's how it should work.
Where would the entrance be to the facility? Off of Third?
Right. The entrance, there's an existing driveway there that we're going to utilize. It's up at the northeast corner of Third. And we're going to do it where there's at least two trucks stacked. So you'll be able to have two trucks pulled completely in, end to end, when they come off of Third Street.
And on a given day, how much in and out are you anticipating with the trailers?
There is a traffic scoping form that was just done. What we did is Mahmoud asked us to take a look at the Schneider facility that we just built to look at the number of trips per day. It's over a 24-hour period. I think it was 200 and something trips per day. Mm-hmm. But their peak, a lot of their peak is very late. So they didn't have any conflict with peak traffic hours for the city. So it was a pretty good comparison.
I asked only because I'm concerned. On one side of that property, we have a large apartment complex. Families and so forth. Where you're located, I know that corner because there's a gas station there, there's a Mexican food restaurant, and it's very close to the intersection. Now, Third Street comes from City Hall all the way down. This, I've experienced a lot of traffic going that way.
Sure.
And traffic coming this way, because on the other side of the apartment complex is the sheriff's station, which, and the county motor pool. A lot of traffic and county employees. So I travel that route quite often. And there's a lot of traffic on Waterman, which is a main street, and then from 3rd Street, which is a main crossroad. So it just seems to me that it's very close to that corner, and I was wondering what the operation was, what you anticipated in and out, because you're talking about large trailers, and as it is, when you're coming out of the gas station, because sometimes I gas there, you know, it's zip, 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 you know, before I can get out. So I wonder, you mentioned a study that was done. Your department look at it, Mark, or planning?
Well, I'll let Mary talk about that as the project planner, but as Mr. Bondeman referenced, we do have a city traffic engineer, and he does review every project. He works very closely with the planning staff from the very inception of the projects all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
So he's involved in every project. He attends the development review committee meetings and makes recommendations on all projects.
So what does he say about the safety of that corner large trailers coming out and little cars trying to vision being blocked and that kind of stuff?
Well, again, I'll let Mary get into the details, but the project wouldn't be here if the city's traffic engineer weren't recommending approval. He needs to recommend approval before it can advance to the Planning Commission.
So that still doesn't answer my question. What does he say about the safety factor of all that? I understand that his recommendation is important, and if he did recommend it, he probably found nothing, but I'm interested in the details.
I can probably answer it the best. So we sat down with Mahmoud quite a bit because we were looking at, you have one driveway, and we were looking at the split for traffic. So if you were to leave this site, we could force, this one thing we talked about doing, we could actually force the trucks to turn right. If they went right, then they would go out down Tippecanoe or Mountain View, go across the new Mountain View Bridge, except apparently there's some congestion there from Amazon. Waterman is a trucking corridor, so trucking is allowed on Waterman. So our scoping form, like I said, what we did is we looked at the Schneider facility because it's brand new, it's in the city, and we were able to scale that down to this site. The numbers in our traffic scoping form are actually so low for the number of trips per hour, it probably shouldn't even be required for a traffic study, is what David Eisenbeis, our traffic engineer, said. He says, they really shouldn't even make you do a traffic study. Between our traffic engineer and the city's traffic engineer, they're going to study it and make sure that they are happy with it. But like I said, the numbers are so low, they didn't even.
Is the business going to have another entry and exit way, or is that
going
to be the only?
No, this will be it. And again, you can stack two trucks end to end in it, in the throat of it. So we're not really too concerned about backups on 3rd Street.
Commissioner Geller?
Yes, what are your hours of operation?
It will most likely be 24 hours.
I gather that when you said that most of the trucks are arriving late.
Yeah. Very typical. I mean, you really have to run it that way because you'll have one guy coming in at 2 o'clock in the morning and one guy leaving at 3 o'clock, you know, that type of thing.
And you had the question. I didn't hear the answer to the chair's question about the surface.
Oh, I missed it. I'm sorry.
What type of pavement?
It will be asphalt. It probably won't be concrete. There will probably be dolly pads for the dollies for their to set down on concrete. It'll most likely be asphalt with a large base. The pavement section on Schneider, I think it was 15 inches. It was very substantial.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Machen?
Yes, would you bring up the site plan, please? I can't see that far, but I'm going on memory. There's two structures on the site that I'm curious about. I think they're drainage structures. I believe they're labeled WQMD. Is that water quality management basins?
Right. So,
and would you explain how they work and where they discharge to?
Sure. This site will have to take care of our drainage. We do a water quality management plan. Our preliminary plan was approved. This site, because of the constraints, will have underground chambers. They'll catch our first flush storm drain runoff, and then they will overflow in existing storm drain easements to Waterman. There's an existing concrete ditch to the south of the existing building at our sort of our southwest corner. So the drainage works just fine. We didn't have room. Typically, like to do an above ground basin, but we didn't have room on this one, so it has to go into chambers.
Commissioner Earp?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I guess my biggest concern with this is the impact of noise throughout the night on the neighbors to the east. I don't know if that's, you know, anything within our purview, but it seems like if I lived there and, you know, all of a sudden this trucking was going to be happening all throughout the night, it'd be a little, more than a little annoying.
That's fair.
Yeah. I don't know. I know that we have noise control in the city. How many decibels of noise you're allowed to make? This is one of those ones that industrial adjacent to living quarters, and they're zoned differently, but sound doesn't respect zoning limits. I don't know how they're going to address that. Do you have any proposals for addressing noise limits?
No. The problem with this site is it was a commercial site and it was supposed to be a commercial park. And it's so many easements on it and it's been bypassed, and really the highest and best use for it is a parking lot, in my opinion. It makes a lot of sense. There will absolutely be noise, and the plan was not to do any other wall to the east. We are doing a very dense landscaping based on planning's recommendation on that side, and that will capture some of the sound. But that's really it. I mean, there's not a whole lot more that you can do. If it was the... You know, we could actually maybe put the truck parking over to the west further. So when they start up in diesel, that's further away from the apartment complex, we can do things like that. But really, there's not a whole lot we can do.
Yeah, it's an operational concern that we're trying to address. As an operational concern, once a facility is placed there, if it's approved, the operation and, you know, existing residents that live there, an invasion of their sleep, sure, as opposed to having a peaceful sleep, because an empty lot doesn't generate much noise.
The empty lot is a mess, though. Yeah. There's a lot of...
So how it's addressed, I don't know how. It'll probably be an operational thing that if residents complain, then there'll have to be a retrofit or a change in operation.
Correct.
If this is put in place.
Right. I mean, that's really, I think, is a trial and error for the noise. We did talk to the apartment complex owner, and he's in favor of it. Atta, who owns the Circle K, is very happy about the project, because he's got a lot of bad things that happen on this vacant property. So I can't promise anything about noise, because there will be noise. And if there's a code enforcement thing, we'll have to deal with it as needed.
Commissioner Machen.
I don't think you really have to worry about noise, because the fire engines will drown it all out anyway. They run about every 20 minutes with their sirens blowing. You won't be able to hear the trucks.
The sheriff's station down the street, too. I mean, it's...
Any other questions for the applicant or for staff?
If I may, commissioners, as you recall, in some of the other applications where it was a sensitive use or one that the commission wanted us to monitor, we could include our standard condition that called for a regular six-month review for a two-year period after the first certificate of occupancy is issued, so that we could monitor it and make sure that they're operating in the manner that was approved here. And if there's any issues that come, and we work with the applicant to resolve those, and if there's any additional comments, we can come back to the commission and revisit the project at that time. We've done that for other projects in the past, so we can add that condition if you'd like.
Thank you. Yes, I'd like to have that condition placed pretty much on everything that we have developed in this city beyond a single-family residence.
Okay, so noted.
And Mr. Bronneman, you're, as a representative applicant, are okay with that review process?
Oh, sure. This is his second facility in San Bernardino, and we might do one more possibly up on Foothill we're looking at. And so he wants to be a good neighbor, and he's vested in this town. So absolutely.
All righty. Any other questions, comments, suggestions? I would entertain a motion if somebody's so inclined to do that. Commissioner Machen.
I move that the Planning Commission adopt resolution number 2016-68, adopting the categorical exemption and approving development permit P16-05 based on the findings of fact subject to the recommended conditions.
With the additional
Would you restate that additional condition?
That there's a monitoring for 2 years, every 6 months, a monitor by the city staff as to the operation of the facility to make sure it's meeting the full range of what we've requested and conditioned for this operation.
I would add that to the motion.
I have a motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second that.
I have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Two opposed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I've got one question.
Pardon me?
Does this whole dais, does it turn? Because I've always wondered, does the whole thing spin?
It did at one time, many years ago.
Just wanted to know that. I'd love to see that happen again. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Item number four is non-public hearing item. Keep in mind, it is not a public hearing tonight. It's information, basically. Number four is study session specific plan 16-01. Ms. Powers.
Yes. Yeah, bring up my first. Item number four is just a study session, again, for Rancho Palma specific plan. And just to reiterate at this time, recognizing that this specific plans are generally larger, more complex projects, we wanted to just introduce the item. We will take it to you for approval next month. So this month is just to introduce the item. We're not looking to impose any conditions. We're not looking to consider the item for approval or denial at this time. And with that, I'll introduce Eric Flodine of Strata Palma LLC to introduce the item a little further.
Thank you.
If I may, Chair, before the applicant talks, I would like to kind of reiterate what Chantal said. This is informational only. I think it's important because this isn't a notice hearing that the commissioners withhold judgment on the project until it's formally before you. So if there's clarification questions, those are fine, but we really don't at this time want to hear your opinions either for or against the project. We'll take all of that as part of the public hearing when the project comes before you a month from now.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, Chair. Fellow commissioners, I appreciate your time this evening. So this will be an orientation or I could say this would be a dry run for a project that we call Rancho Palma. We've been working with our neighbors and city staff and technical consultants for 2 years now to get to this point. And so before we begin any of our projects, development projects, we hire market experts to basically look at the supply and demand of a local area and basically give us that aspect from a market aspect to see what the area needs, what are the voids in that area, so that as we all put our heads together and think, well, what do we want as sort of a wish list, we also have more of the science of the market and what it can support. So we did that for this project. The site is located here at along off of Palm Avenue. Let me see if this thing works here. Yeah, Palm Avenue. Access is here, and Little League Drive is parallel to the highway. This is Cable Creek Channel, the sports complex, and then the Little League complex here, and the schools. So this property is approximately 38 acres, and it's in the Vertimont area, and I would tell you that the Vertimont area is blessed by having an organized neighborhood association. It's oftentimes difficult for us to come into a community or a pocket of a community and not really know who to talk to. And we always want to talk to the residents, and it really makes it so much easier when you have a group like the VNA. So when we purchased this property in November of 2014, at the recommendation of Councilman Nickel, you can see that from the timeline that just over a month after purchasing the property, I sat down with the VNA executive board, the executive members, introduced ourselves, introduced the property, and then just requested an overall membership meeting for their entire membership. As luck would have it, they were having an organization-wide meeting that same month on January 29th. So on January 29th of 2015, before we created a site plan, before we even put pen to paper, and before that market study, which I already mentioned to you, that was even complete. So without even that input, I led a charrette before the organization. There were about 50 people there, which was great because, like I said, it was already just a normal agendized meeting for the association, so we had great turnout. Going through that charrette and basically, what do you like about the area? What don't you like about the area? What would you like to see in on our property? And what concerns do you have about our property? We go through that visioning with them. And then in May, I came back to to the entire membership. They had an ice cream social that meeting, so I was between them and the ice cream. So I was able to present the site plan that they had provided, their inputs. We were able to incorporate that. I took notes. After that, the VNA basically has a long dark period in the summer because it gets so hot, but also because of the Little League events that are going on, and a lot of their members are associated with that. So in June, I sat down again with the VNA board members and showed them the site plan that we refined based on the community outreach. They made a couple more requests, so I did that and came back to a month later on July 21st and presented the revised site plan to them. The revised site plan that I showed the VNA on July 21st, 2015, is the basis for all the technical studies that we have completed, the CEQA process, which is completed, the draft EIR, the final EIR will be sent out soon. And from that point on, we have, even as recently as last week, we have very open communication with the VNA board. So we have a project objectives. I'm just going to skim through these because you're going to see them again when I come up in a month or so. But working with the neighbors, working with the site characteristics, working with the technical aspects, We came up with a list of project objectives, which includes creating a mixed-use community for the site, delivering an appropriately sized neighborhood commercial center. Some of you with any history of this will know that it's gone through several iterations, not under our ownership, but the neighborhood commercial center is very appropriate for this location. There will be new single-family housing stock in Verdemont with two lot size configurations, which will also allow for a variety of housing sizes and types, which is great for different resident lifestyles in the city. We're going to increase the recreation opportunities by expanding Ronald Reagan Park, and I'll show you a site plan that shows why and how we're doing that. We are preparing we prepared a specific plan for this project at the request of the planning department to really guide development of this project. And that covers things such as the architecture and neighborhood signage, monumentation. Let me just move down. One of the things that we heard loud and clear was the need for RV parking, especially in that area, in that portion of the city. You're right there at the base of the hill. A lot of people have RVs or toys, and they don't really have any place to put them. So we gave up about five lots that we had, took out five lots out of the site plan, and put an RV parking area because the need is there. So the site plan, as I mentioned, this is the site plan that basically V&A has, I won't use the word blessed, but this is the one that incorporated all of their feedback. And on the east side of the project, you can see the neighborhood commercial center, which the specific plan allows for 98,000 square feet of commercial in different configurations. This is the vision of how it is, it would include a grocery store, pharmacy, and some inline retail, along with the standalone pad for a restaurant, a sit-down restaurant, which is direly needed up in that area. And on the west side, you can see there's two colors of residential. The lighter tan color are minimum of 7,000 square foot lots, and the one the darker color is a minimum of 5,000 square foot lots. So the total residential is 120 lots, and that was reduced as we were going through the process with V&A. Actually, the lot sizes went increased as well. You can see on this site plan, and I'll show you on another plan, but you can see there's a triangle across the channel. The channel is colored in green on this plan, but across the channel is a half-acre property that we own, that we bought on the other side, and there's a reason that I'll point that out to you. Again, working with V&A, what we did in the site plan and in the revised site plan is you have this row of homes here along Irvington, and these homes front onto Ronald Reagan Park. I mean, what a gem that is for your city to have, a piece of the Berlin Wall. I mean, it's an amazing treasure. So you have these homes that are fronting on Ronald Reagan Park, and then they have Cable Creek there. Originally, we had a row of homes along our property line. What we did instead is we took out the homes on the northern portion of the site. We took all of those out so that the point of the site that's closest to these homes got additional relief, from any massing along that edge. In addition, because of the way the streets are oriented, these homes that are along here are now forward-facing, right? So now these homes are going to look across the channel, across a park, across the street, across the front yard, and look at architectural frontage, right? Look at the front of homes instead of the back of homes. And here you can see this triangle that is adjacent to, contiguous with the existing Ronald Reagan Park. The linear park, which I was showing you on the previous plan, where we removed homes, we've put in a linear park along there with the tot lot and open space, open play area. And this is a private park. I don't think I've mentioned yet. This is a gated community. The residential area will be a gated community. So this is a private park. These two are also private parks within the community. And what I wanted to mention on this And these two vignettes are actually flipped, so north is to the left. This paseo is on the southeast corner of the site. So we've created a paseo and a water quality basin as needed in this low area of the site. We've created a paseo in here with a self-locking, self-closing gate so that the people, the residents that are living in the community can walk through the community into the neighborhood center instead of walking all the way around the block or because it's inconvenient to get in the car. So the Ronald Reagan Park expansion, you know, right now it's just a weed patch with one tree in it. That's what's there today. So we've designed an area. The park already is full of turf, so we didn't feel that it needed additional turf. So we have more of a field mix, meaning more like a wildflower type mix on this portion of the half acre. Triangle, with a gazebo sort of to serve as a gathering area, in this portion of the park. So as part of the project of approval process and build out, the project will dedicate that half acre of property to Ronald Reagan Park, and it will construct the improvements that you see conceptually on the site plan. As I mentioned, we have a specific plan. The specific plan goes into the architectural themes for the commercial center, and we're envisioning ranch and or craftsman styles for the commercial center, and for the single family is ranch, craftsman, and Spanish. These are all in concert with the architecture that's in that area of Verdamont. We had a fiscal impact and an economic impact analysis created for this project, and the results of those two studies are that at build out, this project will increase the general fund by $332,000 annual net revenue. That's already to a net. That's taking out expenses. So, $332,000 annual net revenue to the city's general fund, provide local opportunities for city residents. That always improves job housing balance and reduces vehicle miles. We're going to improve the existing and roadways that are along the site. During construction, there will be approximately 560 full and part-time employment positions, which is great. But I think probably more importantly for a city in considering a project at operation, at build out, the commercial retail. Will generate approximately 360 full and part-time employment positions. So tonight, I'm glad to provide you an introduction for this. We've worked 2 years nonstop very hard on this, and this is really just a summary, but we look forward to coming back to you in a month or so. And I do thank you for your time and attention.
Commissioner Machen.
Just one question. Could you bring up the site plan again?
Yes, sir. You want that one, or do you want that one?
That one right there. That looks like an orchard down behind the commercial center. Is that what it is?
It is the It is a landscape area in the parking. It's the landscape parking. It's not an orchard. Oh, okay. It does look like an orchard.
Okay.
It's just the. It'll be all the tree wells that are within the parking area.
Okay.
For shade, and I think that's the city's. The city is 50%, I think. But so the coverage is to make the coverage work.
Commissioner Geller.
Plans look beautiful. I couldn't tell from them where there's driveway access to the retail department.
Sure.
Except at the far east side there, but it looks like it's going around the back of retail, like where you'd be loading and unloading. Where is the drive-in access?
Sure, that's a good question. There's two access points. The one that you see for the loading is that's the one you see.
That's what I was loading.
Okay.
Back.
There's two. There are two driveways. There's one here.
Okay.
There's a driveway entrance there and here.
Okay, and our backup material is so small I couldn't tell where it was.
You're right. Yeah.
Okay.
It's hard to see. You give a landscape architect a marker, they're just going to color green all over it. So that's why you can't see it.
Commissioner Quayle.
Yes, are you planning any walkway or bridgeway over to the park area from the site?
No, sir, there's not one planned.
Okay.
Well, I really appreciate the outreach that you've done. I've been at the meetings at VNA. I'm not a member of VNA because I live elsewhere in the city, but I pay attention to what's going on. And I have to say that the outreach that you've done in your coordination with the local residents far exceeds any other developer that's ever come in with a proposal in the 12 years I've been on the Planning Commission. Thank you very much for what you've done so far, and hope to see it goes well.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Commissioner Geller.
Historically, do you happen to know that flood control channel there? Has there ever been any problem? Not in my memory, there isn't, but of overflowing and draining into those open areas?
The channel in that location is already has improvements on it, and it's improved all the way to Little League Drive here.
Okay.
It's improved from Little League to Palm.
Okay.
No, our hydraulic studies show no overflow in that stretch. I can't speak for upstream, but in that stretch, no.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
An excellent presentation, and appreciate seeing what you bring to the public next month.
Thank you very much.
On the agenda next month.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Item number five is a comprehensive sign regulation update.
Item number five, again, is a study session for the sign code update. This is an introduction, but on this one we do very much want your feedback and any considerations that you have concerning signage in the city. Genevieve Shero, the project manager from MIG Hogel Ireland, our consultant on the project, will introduce the study session for you.
Please state and spell your last name for the tape record so we get it accurate.
Sure. Good evening. My name is Genevieve Shero, last name Shero, Sharrow.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me tonight, Chair and Commissioners. We're here to talk about signs, one of my favorite topics, and hopefully one of yours too. What I'd like to talk about tonight is kind of why the city initiated this update and where we are today, and just give just kind of a baseline of what signs we're going to be talking about, and then go into a discussion about some policy topics that we'd like your feedback now, because we're kind of in the beginning stages of this process and we want to make sure that we integrate that into the update process. So, as you know, the city is also doing an update to the development code, the larger development code, and the sign code is a component of that. But it's not part of that update. So as a separate process, the city's sign code was adopted last in 1990, and it could use a bit of a refresh at this point. The project objectives are really to streamline the sign code to make it much more clear and user-friendly. There's also been a number of legal court cases that have changed the way that sign codes can be written, especially with regard to temporary signs. So this sign code would address that. And also look at the staff has always keep a fix-it list of things that have gone wrong, and so updating those. And to look at emerging issues, there's the sign technology has changed a lot in the last 25 to 26 years, so this code update would address that. And also to provide consistency with the general plan and the new development code, the new zones and the new development code would be integrated into this process. So any business owner will tell you that signs are of critical importance to their business. They attract and draw new customers. It's a marketing tool, helps with brand recognition. We also know wayfinding signs are of critical importance to get around town and to get to destinations, business destinations. But they really do also affect the look of a community. So there are certainly ineffective signs that result from too much signage, sign clutter, we often refer to it, but you know, we hear from businesses often that they just want more and more and more, but it's not necessarily going to be an effective sign if you can't find it amongst other signs. It's also very ineffective if you can't see it. So there's a Goldilocks situation that needs to be found with signage, where what is the right balance to identify businesses effectively, but also provide some flexibility so it's not kind of a cookie cutter formulation that doesn't work for every individual site. And also to look at the community in general of not just on a site basis, but how does this look throughout the community? So just to get everybody on the same page with different types of signs that we're talking about in the sign code, one of the most prevalent signs and the one we often think of is the business identification sign on the wall, be it, we call it channel letter or cabinet signs that identify the business. And wall signs can also be painted, and we have to think about different frontages of buildings and how the signs reflect and are sized and placed on a building. Monument signs, the lower scale, kind of a broad structure that can identify either an individual business or a multi-tenant center, are also a component of sign code regulations that we'll be looking at. Awning signs, either on the top of the awning or just on the kind of parallel part to the building facade, are also a component of signage that is generally in addition to a wall sign. We also have projected signs or suspended sign, projected being 90 degrees from the building, suspended coming down from a rooftop, and tends to work well in walkable environments and can really enhance local identification. Roof signs, those that are posted right on top of the roof and project out generally perpendicular to the building, currently are not, new roof signs are currently not allowed in the city. Pylon signs, generally kind of the monument sign that's been brought up higher for better visibility and has, kind of a firm structure to it, and can also, again, be for multi-tenant or single-tenant sites. Pole signs, similar to the pylon sign, but the pole, the structure that it is supported on, is a visible pole. A component of pole signs are the freeway-oriented signs that we have in the city that generally are much higher, oriented toward the freeway to provide better visibility for sites. Of course, there are billboards as well. This sign code isn't really looking at changing any of the billboard regulations in the city, but just want to bring it up that, of course, when we talk about signs, billboards do come up as part of the discussion. And window signs. Currently, the city's code allows for 25% of windows to be covered by window signs as an exemption without a sign permit, and we do see a lot of window signs in the city. And then there's the other leg of sign codes, and that's temporary signage. And this is addressed, this will be addressed very comprehensively because of a recent court case. But the different types of signs, temporary signs that we see generally advertising businesses can be in banner signs, attached to a building, attached to a fence, attached to a structure. Portable signs, the A-frame signs that you see, or what we call here on the right, the feather signs, the big sail sign. But these are the movable signs that folks can bring in at night, and some of them stay out all the time, some of them move in and out. And yard signs or real estate signs, signs that advertise a potential office space for availability or an open house, but that are kind of semi-permanent, that generally stick into the ground but are not a permanent sign. And of course, there's non-commercial signs, political signs, or signs for religious sentiments or directional information that also need to be addressed through temporary signs regulations. And emerging kinds of signs that we are seeing certainly are people signs, the sign twirlers. You know, it's going to come up to tax signs. Tax time is going to come up soon, and there's often a lot of sign twirlers around at tax time, but at any time. This is really an emerging thing that some cities are choosing to regulate and to at least bring some exposure to, because it is really, it's happening everywhere. And also inflatable signs, really just kind of attention-grabbing types of things that may or may not actually have some kind of copy on them that would incline you to believe that it is a sign, but it is an attention grabber. And so something that we want to look at as well. The sign code would also look at the sign review procedures, so the sign permit for permanent signs, temporary signs, and also the option for a sign program. Currently, the code has a pretty ambiguous sign program section, but these are generally for multi-tenant sites to make sure that there's consistency with architecture within the center and signage on the buildings and monument signage, things like that. So we'd like to hear from you tonight as we start to begin the process, so that we don't end up with some signs gone bad. We'd like to hear from you what are any concerns that you see in the community. We know a lot of common issues that come up are sign clutter, how big signs are, and the scale of signs in the context of a given situation, where they're placed, are they legible, design, are they architecturally consistent with the buildings? Are they compatible with the neighborhood where they're located? Are they being maintained? And some non-conforming signs that are in existence. So we know that those are some of the issues that generally come up, but we'd like to talk to you today about how is it working? Are there any particular issues that you have seen coming up? And I'll have some specific prompting questions too, but I first just wanted to see as we start this process so that we can make sure that we get your input early on.
Any questions or comments? Commissioner Quayle?
Yes, thank you. First, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm in the sign business here in San Bernardino since 1961. I'm also the vice chair of the Chamber of Commerce for business support. We have a sign code, and generally speaking, the Chamber of Commerce has always worked with the community to help build the sign code, and that's what we've seen in all the surrounding cities. So this is kind of a new experience working with a group like yourself. And I want to reach out and let you know that our Chamber of Commerce wants to be involved with you also. And I volunteered to put a committee together so that we can work together. But one of the biggest problems, and I've recognized in your local pictures that you have here, and you've done quite a few of them, and I have quite a few also, that the majority of the signs, or a lot of the signs that you have in there, some of those are abandoned signs that should have been required to be removed. The biggest problem our community has is code enforcement. And I'm sure you can probably agree with me there. What happens in our community if a business opens up and they can buy a cheaper sign without getting a building permit and not have to worry about code enforcement, they will buy one. Yeah. So I will have to say the majority of the work we do is out of our community because we have a certain clientele here that doesn't feel as though they have to conform to the ordinances because of the lack of code enforcement. So, and I'm sure you understand what I'm seeing or saying, because you can probably see that in other communities. So we're looking forward to helping you and working with you. And if you'd like to see some of my pictures, I'd be happy to share them with you.
I'd love that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to jump on Mr. Quayle's comments as well, because that's been something that I've brought up to this building several times about we have codes that say that can't have signage blocking windows, and we can go across Court Street and the facilities over there have their windows painted almost 100% with signage. And again, it's a not so much our code is bad as we have no enforcement. We don't have the staff to do the enforcement that needs to be done. Hopefully we're working our way out of it.
And I'll try to respond to both of the commissioners' concerns. Absolutely, code enforcement is an issue. We recognize that as a part of the exit strategy that was approved by the judge on December 6th, we are now starting to look at restaffing throughout all departments. Code enforcement is certainly one of those high priorities within the community. So that is something that we are definitely looking at. That aside, I think most commissioners and probably Commissioner Quill would agree that our sign technology has changed and our code hasn't. So we recognize that we have issues on the enforcement side, but we also think we have issues on the design side and on the standard side. And that's what the consultant is really here to address. We know that as a city, we have some issues that need to be addressed, again, enforcing what we've got. But we also think there's some creative solutions that people can't implement here that they would probably like to. We also know that we have a sign ordinance that doesn't comply with a lot of the recent case law that has come out relative to temporary signs, political signs. There's a lot of First Amendment issues that our sign ordinance doesn't comply with. So if there are questions or thoughts that the commission has going forward on a new sign ordinance, I think that's what we'd like to hear from this evening from the commissioners.
Yeah, I think my own personal experience with it, I've been here for a while, is our big problem seems to be a lack of standards for the electronic message signs. That's ongoing, what would be appropriate, what would be inappropriate, the content, as well as a lot of it is the brightness or lack of maintenance of the signs, where you get in the middle of the night and you'll have the content be a bright whitish colors that's much brighter than a more subdued color, even with the auto dim system on. So I don't know if there's a standard we can work out to give whoever's building the signs and whoever's operating the signs a standard that both works for the community and works for them to get their messages out.
And just for clarification's sake, are you talking in particular about billboards?
Once more, please.
Just for clarification, are you talking in particular about billboards, or are you also thinking about how the evolving sign technology is looking at, and I'll have a prompting question about this too, we're seeing digital signs in window signs, and we're seeing digital signs as part of a pylon sign as a growing trend that we see kind of continuing into the future. So I think that comment, I was just trying to clarify if you're thinking about that in terms of billboards or if you're thinking also in the smaller scale as well.
For me, it's primarily, I'm concerned with the billboard signs because they're not site specific to a particular business, as
right.
opposed to, if that's what you reference, if it's a business and a sign is for the business, I'm pretty sure that there needs to be a different set of standards for that.
Absolutely, yeah.
And how it fits in with the community, the local community. But I feel that electronic signs myself, if they would reduce the sign clutter that we have on the fixed signs that are basically painted plywood, that's what they look like to me. It detracts from our community. Commissioner Quill?
Yeah, I'd like to address that also. There are surrounding cities that have limitations on brightness, and they actually go out with meters and they check the brightness of the signs. These electronic signs, even the billboard signs, have built into their computers a dimming system that will dim down when it gets darker. However, that can always be adjusted too. So the person operating the program and the electronics can adjust that. And again, too, it falls back on code enforcement that if there is a complaint, there is a meter you can go out and put right up next to the sign, and it'll tell you if it's exceeding that brightness. There are some cities that allow what we call high output lamps or slimline lamps or LEDs. And LEDs also can be adjusted for brightness too. City of Riverside has a code that will not allow a high output fluorescent lamp in their sign. So they've actually, going to LEDs, it's become much easier to control that. So there are rules that we should look at other cities and what they've done and take advantage of that. The billboard signs that you see that are electronic, they can all be adjusted, but again, too, that's off-site advertising and fall into a different area. Our city does allow electronic signs to be used for commercial businesses, and they can be controlled and appropriately, and that's what should be done. Again, too, there's a lot of those that are going up without the proper permits also. And like she says, they're the window signs, the real bright signs that these folks are buying from China and hanging them in their windows. There is no lighting control on those. Those are just extremely bright. And they last for a few years, and they burn out, and they buy a new one. And that's kind of how that works. Let me ask you one question. And again, too, this is some of the things other cities have struggled with. According to the code, and our city used to have an inventory and abatement program. According to the code and the business professional code, it states that if a city is going to institute a more restrictive code, that they have to have an inventory and abatement program. We had that back in the late 80s, early 90s. Since then, that's been non-existent. There were some legal problems about taking down some signs that were abandoned and that type of thing. But in working with the new code, how do you work around that business professional code law?
So that business and professional code requirement still exists. If you do have a more restrictive code, that if you are creating nonconformities, there has to be a process for counting all of the signs in the city, documenting them, and then there's the abatement procedures that follow along with that. The time and cost associated with that process is often not feasible. At this point, we don't know that we will be more restrictive in a way that would trip that again. But if we do, we'll definitely have to look at that. That is it's a state law impediment that exists.
Yeah, that seems to be a hurdle for some communities that are trying to do something, especially add new things to their ordinance, new things to accommodate the new type of lighting that is out and the electronics and that type of stuff. So it is a hurdle.
That is something, I'll follow up on what Genevieve was saying. That is something that we're aware of. There is also what we've talked about, at least at the staff level, about abandoned signs. Obviously, we can still abate, but if we don't have nonconforming provisions, if we're not making somebody comply with the new sign standards, provided the business doesn't change, the location doesn't change, those provisions of the Business and Professions Code wouldn't impact that business. So it's only if we adopt a more restrictive standard and then we put somebody on an abatement schedule. At this time, we're not considering doing that.
Yeah. In the abatement program, there was a provision that allowed to charge back the business for taking their signs down. This city would be so much further ahead right now and look so much more beautiful if some of the abandoned signs were taken down when they were abandoned and left on the property or destroyed, because what happens, new people move into those buildings and they'll slip sign faces in those existing non-conforming signs, and then there's not a whole lot you can do, or your hands are kind of tied. So.
No doubt there's things that we should have done in the past. Unfortunately, yeah. We are where we are, and we're trying to look prospectively on what we can do with the new sign ordinance.
Sure.
Yes, I just wanted to kind of roll back really quickly to the billboard, EMCs, anything with movable copy, especially where it's oriented towards freeways and high traffic areas. We are looking at the process as well, not just specific standards. And so one of the ideas that had come up for those specific types of signage was to require development agreements in part so that we can get a little bit of advertisement for the city and then impose additional standards in terms of, you know, the brightness and, you know, what kind of content, not so much, but just some different standards that we'd like to see in place. And again, you know, Mr. Quill is absolutely correct as far as the technology changing. So I think it's going to make our job a little bit easier, but also putting in place the correct process for that.
Commissioner Lopez.
To the question, what sign code issues would you like to see addressed? I would like to see addressed I guess it's under the category of temporary banners. Some of them seem to contribute to the blight itself. Some of them seem to be overwhelming. They're really big, or they don't hang them right because they droop. They've been up there a long time. They're torn, and nobody seems to be removing. But some stores, and most banners that I've seen have been in the small businesses, convenience stores or liquor stores and stuff like that. they sometimes impede the walkway. They're right out, and that might include some of the flags that are posted, like really close to where the sidewalk is, the blow-ups, inflatables, that type of thing, because they are somewhat distracting. And they don't seem to, I don't think, contribute to promoting what product you're selling or your business or anything like that. But the banners, for me, seems to be, and hand-in-hand with that is also the window signs, because I'm envisioning one right now, one store, which it's ugly. They got bars all over. Then they got these banners that I don't even think the special is on anymore that are still hanging and drooping. And then they have numerous, my five-year-old rude this up, signs advertising, and usually they're in those color sheets or poster boards and so forth. But they're just like indiscriminate. They're just all over the place. And it seems to, we're talking about aesthetics, and I would think they would be concerned about how the front of my business looked, you know, because I think people also want something that's appealing and clean and so forth. But those two, I do have issues. I would think that something would have to be considered, like how many you could have, what size, how soon they need to be removed. If they are temporary and only advertising a special for a certain period of time, that they couldn't exceed, you know, hanging out over the pedestrian walkway and so forth, and if they are hung correctly so that they are safe to be considered, you know, for those things.
Thank you.
Commissioner Geller.
I reviewed all the material in the backup related to what was existing and the areas you're recommending changes, but I don't remember all the verbiage that was there in relationship to political signs. And I know many cities kind of throw up their hands and say it's too overwhelming, we don't want to have any rules about it, but was there anything in there about political signs on city-owned properties?
No, so as part of the recent legislation that I've been alluding to, it's called Reed versus the Town of Gilbert.
I read that.
So because of that legislation, we are generally counseled not to call out political signs as a sign type. So the goal is really to talk about temporary signs in general. And thus, it becomes very interesting now. And cities are in a very interesting situation because this law just court case just happened last year. Mm-hmm. A lot of cities are now looking at how do we do this effectively while meeting the intent of the case law, but still effectively do what we need to do. So what the city of San Bernardino did was just repeal that entire section of the code. So that is now, there's nothing specific that is said about political signs, where they can be placed, how big they can be.
It's just a temporary sign.
It is a temporary sign. The general recommendation is that codes can include a parameter that allows different types of and different lengths of temporary signage in a certain period before an election. So that would allow all different types of temporary signs, say in the 120 days running up to an election. So it will become a different conversation in the new code than the way that we normally think about it.
Interesting.
It's a little tough, yeah.
Yeah, on that subject, placing signs, unauthorized signs on public right-of-way, particularly adjacent to streets, highways, etc., is a violation of state law, streets and highway code, and the problem we have is because they're, as Commissioner Geller, they're political signs, people are afraid to touch them. Sure. I do know that if you post it on a state highway, state crews will go and remove it. And if there's a large number of them where they have to dispose of it, the campaign for that politician is charged for the cost of removal and disposal. Is that something that we could see in our code, that if you violate the code, it's going to cost you money? Not just the cost of the signs, but the cost of a city crew or a contractor to go out and remove illegal signs, being illegal meaning unauthorized, wherever their location is. Because the state used to send crews out on private property to remove billboards that were in violation of the outdoor advertising standards. So is any of this going to be something that can be included in a code within the city's code, either by reference or stuff, or set of standards for the city to recoup the costs of people that do not get permits or do not get authorized signs, just post signs out wherever they feel like? Because I'm sure that sign companies that are professionals, et cetera, would like to see everything in a cleaner, more organized fashion rather than the mess that we see on some of our principal arteries through this city. It looks like a zoo of signs.
Sure. I think there's a couple things there. Generally, you know, signs are not permitted in the public right-of-way. So that is that's a standard that does exist and can be enforced. Often what sign codes will do will be to punt to the public nuisance portion of a code to say, you know, this is how it is directed into the processes through public nuisance. It would be a bit of a question for the city attorney, I think, too, of how you would, if that would be okay, and if you'd want to do that.
I'm not familiar with the streets and highways code provision that you're referring to. There's a possible problem if it intends to regulate the entire field that it would preempt a local ordinance that would do the same thing. So that would have to be looked at before we modified our code to include provisions like that. Assuming there weren't any preemption issue, then we could do that. What was suggested, though, incorporating into the nuisance definition of a nuisance in other parts of the code, signs that don't conform, if it's not already in there, which it may be, I haven't checked recently enough to say, but that would be one way to enforce what you're talking about, because the nuisance provisions of the code do provide that the owner of the property can be charged. And they provide that the person who's causing a nuisance can be charged for abating the nuisance.
Well, my problem is it would be city property. City can be charged for somebody putting a sign on the city?
Well, if the person caused a nuisance on public property, then they could be charged for it. Okay. Typically, the way the nuisance law is enforced, it's enforced against the property owner for allowing the nuisance to be maintained, even if the property owner didn't cause it. But in this case, if the city owned the property, then whoever caused the nuisance to be there. I've seen cases where the city issued violations on its own property, not knowing that it owned the property. But that's not the typical case.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Gallagher.
One more question, and then I'll quit. I'm not sure what meat you could put into it, but because we live in such a high wind area, a lot of the temporary signs have become hazards in which they are blown literally into traffic, causing people to swerve, and it's dangerous. And I don't know if something can be added to the code in relationship to temporary signs in which how they are secured. Not only does it contribute to the blight, but it is a safety issue when they are blown into traffic, and it happens a lot, especially when there's overabundance, when we have temporary signs previously labeled political signs. Yeah.
Thank you.
Commissioner Quayle.
One more comment or question. I know our city does allow for temporary banners for special occasions and that type of thing. Are there any communities that require a deposit or something of that nature, to where if you don't remove the sign, you're going to forfeit your deposit? Are any cities doing that, such as campaign signs with the same situation?
Sure, that's a really interesting idea. There's not that come to mind right now, but that's something we could certainly explore as a process.
Yeah, because I know for a fact that the auto dealers are conscientious about the laws and the rules for the banners and the streamers and the sale type stuff, but there's a lot of businesses that is their main sign, is the banner. So, you know, they just
does that exist for the temporary?
Well, when you're talking about special events specifically, we do actually have a provision where special events are concerned, temporary use permits,
right.
Pumpkin patches, Christmas tree lots, whatever the case is.
Right.
If it's on a vacant lot, we do charge a $1,000 deposit, which they don't get back if the city has to come and clean up the site afterward.
Could we do that on On a commercial business?
That would include signage. On a commercial business, that we may be able to do something like that for the temporary signage. We'll consider that.
Because banners are considered temporary.
Maybe speak to the city attorneys about
signage.
You know, potential legalities with any of that.
I think that would be helpful because the argument always seems to be code enforcement has a big job, and it costs money for us to send code enforcement officers out there.
Yes.
But if these people don't take care of their own signage and blight, then they're going to forfeit that deposit, and will code enforcement come take it down or have someone take it down? You know, it's just a thought. I don't know. I don't know of any community to do that.
And again, you know, process is one of the things that we're looking at, so we'll definitely consider that. Thank you.
Commissioner Jones.
What is the current application process for temporary signage within the city of San Bernardino?
An applicant would fill out the application form and show us some sort of diagram or drawing or picture of the temporary signage that they intend to put up on their property. There's a base fee that they pay. Currently, we don't restrict the number of temporary signs that you can have. So we kind of just try to make good recommendations. But generally, I think that people put up more signs than what they actually tell us they're putting up. So that could be something that we look at in terms of limiting the number of signs specifically. But currently, they just show us the signage, approximately where they plan on putting it on the property with the application and the fee, and we either approve or deny that, generally at the counter.
So the entire application process would need to be completed at City Hall, basically, in person? And
yes.
From start to finish, what's the actual like turnaround time for processing for temporary?
Maybe about 15 minutes.
Oh, okay. So
yeah.
Excellent. Same day.
Yeah.
It's business friendly.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So you might have to wait longer than that, but once someone actually sits down with you, and we try to keep those wait times down as quick, you know, as short as we can. We have more staff now at the counter, so the wait times are shorter generally. Plus, you know, a planner can come out and help somebody if our you know, our technicians are busy with other applicants. But yeah, the process itself only takes about 15 minutes.
Would we be able to like geographically lock those locations in when we issue the permit to them or when they apply for it? Like basically say, if you're going to have a sign on Baseline and Waterman on the southwest corner, and this is where we're issuing you this provision to post your sign, and you're responsible for the upkeep, or is there a certain way we can actually lock in those locations so that we're not just issuing a permit to someone, giving them an infinite amount of signs or banners to distribute within the city, because that also contributes to like blight and
so I think one thing that we often recommend is that through the temporary permit process, the permit number is required to be put somewhere on the temporary sign, so it makes it much easier then for code enforcement to be able to pull it, know it had a permit at one point at least, or it did not have a permit, and if it did have a permit, how long ago. It's much easier to look up and even can look up in the field. So that's one mechanism that could help facilitate that. And it could also tell you then if they've moved it, because if they look up the permit, they can look up the information for where it was issued.
If it was located somewhere else originally, then we know that they just moved the sign without then getting a new temporary use or temporary sign permit for that.
Right. Okay. Excellent. And then also, moving forward, would we be able to have the application process also available online? So that if we have applicants that are, like, if there's a special event going on and they had a representative that was out of town that needed to apply for that permit or something like that, is that something that they would be able to do? So then at least that way, for the people that are not in compliance, that are not able to go down to City Hall and apply, if we can have that additional channel available to them, so at least we can start registering the people that are applying for permits so that if they're not in compliance, we'll be able to go after them versus them not having any type of records with the city and where they're going to be distributing the signs at in the first place as well. Is that something we would be able to implement once the new codes are completed? Or
that's a great idea, and it's actually something that we've wanted to do for a long time. Actually implementing it, though, has been a bit more of a challenge, and it's kind of a larger issue that we would have to take up with our IT staff and how to actually do that. Unfortunately, the process isn't very smooth right now. I know that in the planning department for some types of permits, we will try to encourage people to send us PDF files wherever they can and, you know, maybe mail in a check, and then we can you know, issue a permit that way. So we do some electronically, but streamlining it as a regular process that the city just does is really a more complicated issue. I think it's something that we are looking at, but I don't know exactly how long that might take.
Okay. Thank you.
How long is temporary?
90 days.
How many?
90.
90 days. And then I was thinking in terms of what Commissioner Quill was saying on a business and a forfeiture of filing fee if they fail to either maintain or remove at the end of the 90 days. I don't know if I like 90 days being a temporary.
I believe at one point the auto dealers could have 30-day increments, and they could have 3 a year, something along that line. I don't really use that too much, that part of the ordinance, but I thought it was limited to 30 days, but 3 times a year or something.
I think the current language states that you can have 90 consecutive days within a 180-day period. So basically, we've interpreted that to mean that you can have your sign up for about 3 months, and then you have to take it down for about 3 months. And then if you want to put up new signage, you have to start the process again. So basically, you can have it up if you have the sign up for that 90 days. You would have basically twice a year that you would be allowed to have that signage.
I heard you mention a little while back about labels on signs, and actually our city, San Bernardino, used to do that. We had a beautiful metallic label with a number on it, and that was your sign permit. Well, if they did that with banners also, it'd be so easy for code enforcement to spot an illegal sign or an illegal banner.
Yep.
Instead of going through and calling and asking all the information.
Exactly.
Doesn't have a number on it. It's not permitted.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, that was real good thing back years ago. The law requires you to have a UL label on electrical sign anyway, and a manufacturer's label. So there's nothing wrong with having a permit label also.
I think that's something that we'll definitely consider.
Anybody else?
I have a couple of leading questions, if you're ready for those.
We're ready.
All right. Okay, so temporary signs, we've talked about a lot, but in particular, the portable signs I'd like to ask you about. So these are the A-frame signs that you see businesses carry out, and it's either the A-frame or they can be more of the plastic structure that you see on the side. And we see a lot of these, and businesses like them, especially for pedestrian traffic. The current code does not allow portable signs like this. So the question that we'd like to hear from you to think about a little bit, should San Bernardino change its process to allow these types of signs? Some cities have been doing this to facilitate just business activity and pedestrian activity in the district.
I would vote no as well, because they sit them out in the sidewalks, and that's it impacts anybody under ADA, and there's no control right now of it, because they're using them even though we don't allow them. So that'll fall back onto when we staff up on code enforcement. It should be a situation where any officer going by, that's a violation, you get a ticket for that. And not just, our police have other tasks, but without enforcement, you can have all the rules you want. If you have no enforcement, they're meaningless. Commissioner Herb?
Yeah, I was going to say that, I don't have a particular objection if they're
done well. You know, I go into sandwich shops and they got the special on a little board out in front. It's out of the sidewalk, out of the way, it doesn't bother me for that. I mean, I understand there's some situations with a problem. I don't know about wholesale.
Now, would open house signs be included within this provision?
No, because open house signs are generally, they usually stick them in the ground. We will struggle a little bit, I think, with open house signs as we move forward with this, as all cities are struggling right now, because calling, and we'll work through this, I think, in a little more detail, but the real estate signs in general are such a different animal. You know, they have their times, and they're really associated with a particular use. So as we develop the temporary sign regulations, we're going to have to look carefully at that.
I think, again, the same thing with the political signs, content being the issue there.
Right. So I hear largely no.
You want a straw vote?
Straw vote would be great.
All in favor of having A-frame signs being allowed?
I'm in favor of disallowing.
Oh, all opposed?
Allow or disallowed? Disallowed.
Disallowed. Looks like we got 4-3.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they don't look like that.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about digital and LED signs then. These two examples show a little bit more of the trends that we're seeing today. A lot of car dealerships are using the LED or the electronic sign as part of their pylon sign to advertise the specials. We see a lot of this on freeway signage, and traditionally we thought of these a little bit more on like on schools, on churches, but we're seeing a lot more of a commercial aspect to these as well. And the picture on the right shows the window sign that we're seeing more and more of as well. So there's kind of the two different animals of the billboard signs, which has kind of a very visible view for the city. And that this commission generally will see and that we recommend, including the development agreement for, so that the city can regulate that and also have the checks on it that a development agreement has. But for these other kinds of signs that we do anticipate getting more of, should these on-site digital signs be reviewed at the staff level rather than kicking it up to this body to streamline review and have those approvals to be able to be facilitated a bit more quickly if the performance standards are in place to regulate the issues of brightness and things like that.
I think they should be on-site digital signs with the right criteria set for the standards should be approved at staff level rather than having to come to Planning Commission for on-site. On that light of that, there needs to be a regulation on no, because I've seen this, advertising sign with rotating amber, flashing red, flashing blue, attracting signs on top of their signs. That's a hazard to workers that work on the highways, on the streets, and for emergency vehicles. If you have red, blue flashing lights or amber flashing lights, you're detracting from it. There should be something in our code that says that's prohibited completely because it's a detriment to the safety of the people that have to serve us.
And that does exist in the code today, and also we can put regulations on the length of time that the copy would be up and the time between switching so that it's a seamless switch and there's not the kind of eye-catching thing that would happen from a break. So that would help too.
We do currently prohibit blinking, flashing, and that sort of thing.
I may misunderstand, but I think he was talking about the bright lights or arrows or flashing things that grab attention.
Oh, so not on an LED sign.
Not actually an LED sign in conjunction with an LED sign. There's one on Valley Boulevard in Bloomington area. They have a rotating amber light on top of a little sign.
Yeah, that's not allowed.
It's a beacon, and it looks like there's a crew working there or something. No, it's some hole-in-the-wall outfit that Apparently, the county doesn't have much in the way of sign regulations.
I think that our current regulations already prohibit that kind
blinking,
of...
Blinking, moving,
yeah.
Flashing.
In terms of moving signage, and that's another thing that we'll look at some more, there's some other ideas that we have, but the blinking, flashing, anything like that could potentially be a traffic hazard is already prohibited, and we intend to keep that in place.
Okay.
I think what should be prohibited also is the window LED signs. Now, a lot of those signs don't even fit into the fire code because they are actually being purchased online or whatever, and they just hang them in a window and plug them in. And you can program a message in them, and they run continuously. You see laundromats and some of the others having those. Mm-hmm. They are very bright. There's only one brightness, and that's bright. And they have a reflection off the glass. And I think our code doesn't allow those anyways. But I don't know if it's ever been brought up.
It's kind of silent on it because it is a new emerging technology.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that we could potentially look at, specific specifications that they have to meet to meet the fire codes and that sort of thing. So we'll look into that.
Yeah. Also the window signs, and I know we discussed that, but, there's a real safety factor about only allowing 25% of the window being painted if they're going to paint it. And I've had discussions with the police department before, and they really discourage that because it presents a problem. If they have to arrive at a site, they can't see in the window. Mm-hmm. The window is painted out.
Yeah.
So by putting these in those windows, too, it's a glare, and it creates a safety issue, too. So,
Commissioner Kelly?
I think clearly that it should be designed so that these things can be approved at the staff level and expedited. I just don't see the need to be bringing this forward to the Planning Commission. But I would also assume that those regulations would be put in place that protect those in close proximity to residential areas so we don't decrease the quality of life for the residents or those issues of safety. And I'm sure that all of those things, the intent would be to include those. And in doing so, I wouldn't see a need to bring it here.
Do you need a straw vote on this? This question.
I think I hear consensus on this one. Pretty. I think we can move to the next question. So this in the outline that was attached to the staff report, we talked a little bit about a new process that we would like to consider for creative signs. And I know, sadly, the Fun Corner did close last month. But they had a really fun, cool sign with the movement. But the movement, again, is not permitted by the code. So a creative sign permit, a creative sign process, would provide a mechanism to deviate from the code if it meets performance standards and goes through a thorough review by the Planning Department or the Planning Commission, depending on the level of review that we would want to see there. A variety of deviations can happen. We're seeing signs being integrated into architecture in very interesting ways that really add aesthetically to the community, to the building, and can just be really creative. And so this provides an avenue to encourage that creative sign process by allowing deviations to the code. We see a lot of new and older types of what we call lifestyle graphics. And these don't necessarily have a business name on them, but they represent what is located in that building. So, for instance, a doggy daycare with a beautiful mural of dogs and cats outside that if you didn't know it was a doggy daycare, you wouldn't necessarily know the connection there. But they do have the potential to enhance if they're done well. And if they meet the criteria. So this creative sign process could allow for some mechanism to allow that to happen. So we would like to include this mechanism in the new code. And we wanted to ask you, are there certain parts of the city where this wouldn't work, where we really want to constrain signs? Or could this be open to basically within, you know, with the discretion of the of both the performance review and the staff and or planning commission review, could this process be integrated into the code, or are there areas of the city that we should think about not allowing deviations from the code?
Commissioner Gill.
This is an interesting area in relationship to signage, one that I really hadn't thought of until it appeared in the backup material. Were you recommending that when people apply for a creative sign that would, though, come before the Planning Commission? Was that going to be your recommendation? Or
it's a question, too. And there could be degrees as well of deviation from the code. You know, if it's only deviating 5 or 10% from the code, maybe that's something that could be reviewed at staff level. If it trips another threshold, it could maybe be kicked up to the Planning Commission. The process itself, I think, is open for discussion, and we're looking for your input on that as well.
I'll just add my thought on this a little bit. It seems to me that, especially with the creative signage, it may be a little difficult to perfectly craft the standards for it. Mm-hmm. And I think that just, coming together with a meeting of minds and saying, is this representative of something that we want in the city, or is it not? Maybe the best process through a sign program, we can present that to the Planning Commission, and you can say yes or no, we like it or we don't.
It would definitely be on an individual basis, I would assume. Absolutely. It would be hard to craft some kind of standard for that.
Commissioner Quayle.
Probably a really good example of what you're speaking about there is right up here at our California Theater. We have a mural of Will Rogers on those elevations of the elevator shaft. And then we have the vinyl aluminum framed things for the shows. Those look real nice.
They do.
If you include those in a sign code, would they have to meet, how would you restrict it to the square footage? Or is there a difference between graphics or signage or architectural elements or that type of thing?
Right. We would look at all of that. We may want to limit the size of them on the building, but I think, again, we would like the process to be something that we all agree upon. And so we'll craft some standards for it, but I think this is going to be probably a more flexible part of the code, and we'll take it through a sign program and then present it to Planning Commission.
I would encourage it because
we are very much in favor of this process.
Because the technology today is the printing process and the frameworks and so on that you can put these elements in. It's very nice.
Right. And we agree. And I think that they really add to any, business, especially, if you're talking about a highly walkable area, like we're trying to get the downtown area to be, drawing attention and interest to the area will only make people want to be here even more.
Sure.
So this would be applicable to what I refer to as a mural. As well,
I think the legal definitions get a little tricky there, but
right. We like to keep murals separate from. It feels like a mural, but if it is selling something and it has an economic benefit or it has an economic linkage to the product or the service on which it is located, that's when it becomes less public art and more. It falls kind of in both realms, right? So that's where this process then comes in because it's a little bit of both.
Okay.
So I hear support for the creative sign process. Is there any concern about certain areas of the city that it wouldn't be okay to look at this, or we can kind of look at it in general?
I think what end up it'll be community standards as presented in this body. If people are aware of this type of signage going to be placed in their neighborhood, we encourage the public to come in and tell us what they think, whether a yay or nay. And that's what this body's for, is decisions to help the city and developers and people putting signs up meet the community standards that are presented to us.
All right, next question. iconic signs. San Bernardino has some great historic signs. So this falls, it could fall a little bit into the creative sign process, but we want to think about this. Is there the desire to encourage retention of these signs or even require retention of these signs as businesses change and as the uses change in these spaces? There's certainly a sense of identity that is associated with these signs, and we wanted to talk to you about what your thoughts are on either encouraging their retention or requiring them. This could be through a process of designating certain signs that either the property owner or the city or either or designate a particular sign as a heritage sign or an iconic sign, and then encourage the retention either on site or through other mechanisms.
Two of the signs in those photos are pretty much abandoned, and they should be caused to be removed because they may not fit into the existing ordinance we put up quite a few years ago. I like them, but the ones are maintained properly.
Right. There's a guy out in Barstow who has a great field of them.
Well, any time that you're going to categorize signs subjectively like that, to say they're iconic or not iconic, or creative or not creative, you're going to run into problems if you deny somebody the right to have their sign on the basis that you don't think it's creative enough or you don't think it's iconic enough. And you also have to be aware that somebody may say, I don't want that sign anymore, even though you think it's iconic because it has nothing to do with my business. It's a bowling alley, and I'm not running a bowling alley. Maybe you've had experience with other cities that have been able to overcome those drafting problems, but I see those as something that would have to be addressed.
And some cities will look at these signs as, look at different options for retention, maybe not on site, but require that you take the sign down and
move it,
or make it available to somebody to keep. I'm sure. Yeah.
I don't think, based on legal advice, that we should require the preservation of what is called a heritage or iconic signs, because defining the sign is such. But I think we should encourage people to maintain and preserve the signs where possible, because this city has lost too much of the historical elements of the city, which are distinctive to this city. And signage is a very visible part of the identity of San Bernardino. It'd be great if we had the original McDonald's sign still up there.
Right.
As it was.
Yeah.
But that was a corporate decision that said no. They couldn't keep it. So I would encourage the city to encourage the preservation of these signs. But to put it as you have to, I don't think that'll fly. Because the definition of it's not objective. It's subjective completely as to what is iconic or a heritage sign. If it comes down to it, it would probably be something that should be put to the community as to whether this one should or should not come down. And we do have a historical commission that could review things like that, even though it is not historical in the normal sense of historical, more than... Well, some of these may be more than 50 years old. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yes. But if we encourage the preservation of it, that means that the current owner of the property then is required to maintain this sign, or encouraged to maintain the sign. If failure to maintain the sign and it becomes an abandoned sign, then at that point, then it becomes something that possibly should be removed. Mm-hmm. My opinion.
So I think I hear kind of consensus on that, of encouragement on that. And that was the last of my prompting questions. So I very much appreciate the input, and Laura's been taking studious notes. So we will be taking this back and working with staff to craft some more ideas, and working, we'll have a business community outreach process to get more input as well later on.
I would encourage any of the commissioners, if you have any ideas that you'd like to talk about, any concerns that come up in between now and the next presentation, feel free to email me those concerns anytime, and we'll take those into consideration.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. So one final thing, if I can, before Genevieve leaves. I know Commissioner Quill, we had talked previously, and they're aware that you were a signed contractor about getting together a subcommittee of the chamber. Should we try to schedule something sooner? Have you had a chance to talk to the chamber membership about that?
I have spoke to the chamber, and they're excited about that.
Okay.
In fact, we're having a executive board meeting Saturday, and I'm going to share cards with these ladies, and then we can get in touch with them and set up some meeting times and discuss some of the interests some of the business community would like to share with you, too. So,
fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you for your presentation.
I have one more question, and it may not be applicable to this. Do we have any certain provisions that are going to be implemented in regards to mobile billboards within the city of San Bernardino?
That's an excellent question. We don't have anything in the code right now. It's kind of a split between the streets, regulating the streets and regulating signs, and generally it falls into the streets category. But we should look at that and see if there's anything that we need to include.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Interesting. I hadn't even thought about that. We're going to go back to looking. I'm going to look for volunteers for a subcommittee, three members, to work on with staff on developing a revision to our bylaws. I have three. We have Commissioner Galler, Machen, and Jones that are interested in that. And yeah, thank you. I don't see any public other than applicants. Planning Commission reports or announcements? Being none. I have one. Vernamount Community Center is currently closed for rehabilitation. Public Works is fixing the building and making it all ADA compliant and stuff. So it'll be closed for about 90 days. Director's report.
Yes, thank you, commissioners. Just a couple of items. I'd like to hand out the major, or have Melina actually hand out two items. One is the major projects list, which was emailed to you. And then the second is the newsletter, departmental newsletter, which was also emailed to you, but thought I would also give hard copies as well in case there are any questions. I also want to update the commission on items which are going to the City Council next week, the 19th, that are related to the Planning Commission's jurisdiction. The first item, the City Council will be having a public hearing on the Waterman Baseline Specific Plan. The Planning Commission saw the specific plan and did recommend approval to the City Council. So there'll be a hearing next week on that. There's also the second reading of the general plan amendment and zone change for Mary's Village, which is the men's transitional housing facility on Walnut, which the Planning Commission actually saw probably 7 or 8 months ago. It's been a while. It's been before the City Council, I should say, on several separate occasions. So they did conduct the public hearing at the last meeting on December 5th. They did recommend approval, so this is just the second reading of the ordinance. There's also the second reading of the ordinance on the drive-throughs, allowing drive-through restaurants in the CR3 zone on Hospitality Lane. Again, there was the public hearing on the 5th, and this is just a second reading. And the third or fourth item, actually, is Arrowhead Farms. This was a general plan amendment and zone change, or just a zone change, I should say, within the unincorporated Arrowhead Farms neighborhood. The Planning Commission actually recommended against approval of the zone change. The City Council, when they held the hearing on November 21st, reversed the recommendation of the Planning Commission, and the City Council is approving or recommending approval of the zone change, or actually I should say adopted the ordinance on first reading, or had the first reading on November 21st. What's coming back on December 19th is the second reading to approve that, which would allow the applicant to continue to work with the county on approval of their 51-unit condominium project. And that concludes my report. I'm happy to answer any questions.
On that Arrowhead Farms, does that have to go through a LAFCO approval?
It does not, because the project is still within, the property is still within the unincorporated sphere of influence for the city. The reason that it came, even has to come to the city at all, is the City Council adopted a resolution in, I believe it was 1989 or 1990, that said if a property was in the sphere of the city's influence, and but was served by the city, in this case the project is served, sewer service is provided by the city. And that project didn't comply with the city's zoning, pre-zoning, then it had to be pre-zoned, if you would, as if it were in the city. So it is, I think it was actually pretty forward-thinking for the City Council to adopt that ordinance back in the late 80s. So that's why the city is even looking at the land use. It's because they need a service, sewer service in this case, from the city, that they need to comply with our pre-zoning. So it's very unusual for cities to do this. It's pretty forward thinking, like I say. But to answer your direct question, it wouldn't go through the LAFCO process because it's still an unincorporated San Bernardino County.
Which is a little confusing to me because it had to go through the LAFCO process, which the council denied for the Spring Trails project up in the Vertimont area, which was, again, an unincorporated area that was in the city's sphere of influence, and the same thing on a zoning change. And the council said, no, we're not going to recommend you go to LAFCO.
Well, the difference actually between Spring Trails and this Arrowhead Farms project is that applicant was trying to become incorporated into the city.
Okay.
So that's why Spring Trails had to go through the LAFCO process, because we approved the specific plan for Spring Trails. The city of San Bernardino approved that because the county would not. So he's incorporating in order to get his project approved, or seeking incorporation into the city to get his project approved.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That clarification, I get confused sometimes.
Yeah.
With some of the laws and regulations are
not a problem. That's what we're here for.
Any other questions for Director Persico? I'll entertain a motion for adjournment to Wednesday, January 18th at 6 p.m. here. I have a motion. I have a second. All in favor? There we go.
Sorry, one last thing. Tomorrow night is the commission dinner.
Yep.
Hopefully you all have already RSVP'd, and hopefully we'll see all of you, or at least the majority of you, tomorrow night. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry, for being
Thank
here.
You, for standing in.
You know that business. I have. That was great. I appreciate it. Pardon me? You too.